Today is June 27th, 2014. This is Fidencio Marabella with the Westchester Public Library in Westchester, Illinois. Also present is Patrick Callahan, reference librarian here at the library, and Burnett Richmond, circulation supervisor here at the library. Today we will be speaking with Mr. Bob Blackwell. Bob served in the USAF from March 56 through September 58, and again from February 64 through February 68, and highest rank he achieved was as a captain. This interview is being conducted for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress. Okay, let's go ahead and get started. Bob, why don't you tell us a little bit about growing up in Mobile, Alabama?
Okay, again, I was born in 1934. We lived just north of the Air Force Base in Mobile, and at age 9, 1943, I used to stand by the back fence and watch airplanes go into the Air Force Base, and I decided right then that if I'm going to war, I'm going in one of those, and that's exactly what I did. We were on the Gulf of Mexico, and I spent a lot of time over on the Gulf, et cetera, et cetera, and played the trumpet in the band and marched in all the Mardi Gras parades and went to the University of Alabama in 1951 and graduated in the end of, actually January 1956 with a mechanical engineering degree and a second lieutenant commission in the Air Force. Okay. And 2 months later, I was on active duty and got into the flying game shortly thereafter, and I flew for 52 years.
Wow, okay. So you started off, as soon as you graduated from college, you ended up...
2 months after I graduated from college, I was on active duty.
Okay. So where did you do all... Did you go through boot camp and everything?
I had summer tours during college in the ROTC program.
Okay. Can you tell us about those?
Well, as much as I can remember, we'll put it that way. My 1 4-week tour of duty was at Bergstrom Air Force Base in Austin, Texas. And as I recall, that was a SAC base with the big bombers, the B-47s, and this, that, and the other. And we were the underlings on the base, as it were. So they worked us over like the old master sergeants used to do in boot camp. But I never was really subjected to the old master sergeants.
Okay, that's good.
So anyway, after I got through with that in my ROTC program in Alabama, I got my commission and then off to flying school.
Okay, where was flying school at?
I started off number one at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. Everybody in the whole Air Force starts at Lackland.
Okay.
Okay, and after I got through with Lackland, I was assigned to Bainbridge Air Base in Bainbridge, Georgia, which is down on the southern tip of Georgia. And this is where we had the T-34s and the T-28s, which were propeller-driven aircraft. And that's the first two machines that I flew during my aviation career.
Okay. What was your first flight like? Do you remember that? Can you tell us?
Well, I was very excited. Like I said, when I was 9 years old, I decided I'm going to do that. So I was very excited, and I soloed in a minimum number of hours. It's about 9 or 10 hours, as I recall, with my instructor in the back seat.
Okay.
Now, I recall specifically on the day that I did solo that my instructor was sitting out at mobile control, and some of the other students were out there with him, and I took off, and he said, "That's one." And they said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, he's in the air now, but he's got to get back, so that's one landing." So I got my three landings and got out of the airplane, and away we go.
So what was it like your first time flying with an instructor?
You are an underling, very much right, so, because okay. You don't know what you're doing.
Right.
And I certainly didn't know what I was doing. Okay. And this guy was very good. We had a yoke between us.
Okay.
This was what we used to control. And when I screwed up, my knees got hit with that yoke because he's sitting in the back seat like this.
So he's trying to hit you with it?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, to get my attention.
Okay.
And he did a very good job. Now, these were the first 6 months were all civilian instructors.
Oh. Okay.
They were ex-military guys, but they were civilians. Now, when I got into basic, which was where I got into the jets, they were military guys. So, anyway, 6 months, I had 40 hours in a T-34, 90 hours in a T-28, and that was 6 months of concentrated flying and ground school. And then off to Big Spring, Texas, where I got into the Lockheed T-33, two-seated jet trainer, which is what that is right there.
So what was it like?
This one.
Okay. So what was it like transitioning from a propeller to a jet for you?
Very simple.
Was, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You don't have all that torque and all that fooling around to do with. The jet engine, just like commercially, I flew the 727, and everything was in line. You didn't even need the rudders, really, unless you were landing in a crosswind type of thing. Same thing with the jets.
So it was easier than flying the jets, you felt?
It was, yeah, to me.
Okay.
To me. You didn't have that thing whirling around out there and the torque that it puts into the system and all that kind of stuff. So.
Okay. Okay. So how long were you training in jets?
6 months in the T-33, and then I went to Perrin Air Force Base north of Dallas and transitioned into the F-86D.
So that
this aircraft.
Tell us about the F-86.
Well, the F-86 came into being during Korea. That was the fighter version of it. This is the fighter interceptor. You see the black nose on it?
Yes.
That's got a radar in it, and we were on alert. And in the event an unknown target came into the local area, they would scramble us to go look and see what it was. And with the radar, we could pick up the target. We were vectored by the ground radar. And we'd get within 15, 20 miles of it, we could pick it up on a radar and go right into it. So it took about 6 months to transition into this aircraft after I got my wings. And then I went overseas to Tripoli, Libya, and flew it operationally.
Did you ever have any intercepts in Texas?
It was practice.
Just all practice, okay.
Yeah. The T-Bird, we called it, the Lockheed T-33 were the targets at Perrin, and we learned how to fly this airplane and use the radar running on T-Birds.
Okay. So was it pretty difficult learning how to use that radar?
No, piece of cake.
Is it?
But it was a multi-million dollar investment by the federal government, and it was classified as secret. So we couldn't talk about the radar to anybody outside of who we were working with.
Okay. So then you ended up in Libya. How did that happen?
Just assigned.
You were assigned? Okay.
Assigned there.
No volunteer?
There was no. Okay. You don't volunteer in the military service. My assignment came through for the 431st Fighter Interceptor Squadron in Tripoli when I finished up at Perrin Air Force Base in the transition. Now, you may recall oil being discovered in Libya. That occurred when I was there in that squadron in 1958. Okay. And there was also a B-24 that they found in the desert, the oil crews found in the desert, that had crashed after World War II raid in Italy. And they got lost and they wound up down in the desert.
Oh.
And the airplane was preserved from the heat.
Okay.
All the guys were gone, but there's the airplane.
It's still there.
So, wow. But that was 1958 in Tripoli.
Okay. So what was your first impression of Libya when you landed there?
The locals wore their robes and all that kind of stuff. They called them barracans, I think. But you see them sleeping in them in the ditch off the road. The sophistication in Libya, Tripoli, Libya at the time, was the Air Force Base. And outside the gate, it was just completely different. Nothing I'd ever seen like that in my entire life. So I stayed on the base most of the time.
So what was life like on the Air Force Base?
Officers Club opened at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and all us fighter jocks were down there. Wheelis was the gunnery range for Europe, for the fighters. In Europe.
Oh, okay.
And the fighter squadrons in North Africa and Europe would go to Wheelis for 1 month temporary duty every year to fire on the gunnery range. We were the air defense of the area, but there was 125 fighter aircraft operating off that runway every day. Yeah. And we used to go up and dogfight and play around and shoot each other, quote unquote, you know.
So what was it like flying these practice dogfights? Can you describe that for us?
A lot of G's. You know what a G is, right?
Yeah, okay. Force of gravity, yes.
And just whoever could outmaneuver and say, "Bloop, gotcha," and okay, fine. You won, you lost, quote unquote. We just had a lot of fun. And I was the high time man in the squadron as far as flight time, practically the entire 6 months I was over there, and that was 35 hours a month. So we just go up, but the airplane would only stay in the air for about an hour and 15 minutes.
Okay.
If we were in afterburner, we could go through the entire fuel load, 5,500 pounds, in 16 minutes to dry tanks.
So was this before they had like air-to-air refueling?
Yes. Okay. Well, that airplane was not designed for air-to-air refueling.
Okay.
Now, fighters today, I think, okay.
Yeah.
Now, let me back off a little bit. The speed of sound. You're familiar with the speed of sound.
Yes.
When I was going through transition, one of the things that we had to do was penetrate the sound barrier. And in order to do that, we'd go to 42,000 feet, light the afterburner, and roll inverted, and go straight down. And when the airplane went through it, we'd roll a quarter of a turn. And when it came back through in the low 30,000 feet, because of the air density, it rolled back and that was it. I did that twice.
Now, why would they have you breaking the sound barrier? Is it just because?
Part of the curriculum.
Okay.
Now, the airplanes of today and for the last probably 20 years plus will go through the speed of sound in the climb.
Yes. Yeah.
And the reason for that is the thrust of the engine is greater than the weight of the airplane. Okay. This airplane weighed 21,500 pounds, and the engine with afterburner was 7,500 pounds. So there's 3-to-1.
Okay.
So there was absolutely no way we could get it other than the way we did.
So you can only get that by diving?
Yeah,
okay.
In that airplane.
Okay.
In that airplane, yeah.
So how many Gs would you pull?
4 or 5. Now, we didn't wear G suits in this airplane.
Oh, okay.
When the most, well, in the little practice dogfights, we'd
right.
pull 4 or 5, and you had to really, really grunt and to keep from passing out, as a matter of fact. So, you know, just a lot of fun. And when you're 20-something years old, what the heck, let her rip.
Do pilots ever pass out during these practice fights?
Or? Yeah, I'm sure they do. I didn't, but okay. I'm sure they do. But again, all this new equipment, it's got G suits and pressures and all that kind of stuff to keep you from passing out.
Okay. What were some of the things that you liked and didn't like about the F-86?
I liked everything about it. It was a beautiful machine. Beautiful machine.
And the visibility was pretty good?
Oh, yeah. You're sitting in a bubble.
Yes.
360 degrees. So it was good. It was good. Very maneuverable.
So how long did you fly the F-86?
Well, I started in June of 57, so through September 58. So a year and a quarter or something like that.
Okay.
We flew the airplanes from Tripoli, Libya to Zaragoza, Spain. They moved the squadron to Spain. So I that was my last, well, I take that back. That was on a Wednesday. In September of 58, we flew the whole squadron over. And then on Friday, I was one of four up, flying, and screwing around in Zaragoza. And that was the last time I flew the airplane.
Okay. Okay. So what did you end up flying next?
The C-119. I'm a mechanical engineer. And when I got out of the Air Force in September 1958, I went to work in the missile industry.
Oh, with
Arnold Engineering Development Center in Tullahoma, Tennessee. And they are wind tunnels. And I worked, I was down there for about 2.5 years, and I worked on every missile program that was in existence at the time. And then after 2.5 years, I went to Hercules Powder Company in Salt Lake City.
and worked on the third stage of the Minuteman.
Oh, the
Intercontinental.
Is that the ICBM?
ICBM, yeah.
Okay, okay.
Third stage. And while I was in Salt Lake, I got in the reserve unit at Hill Air Force Base, and I was flying the C-119. A lot of difference in the C-119 and the F-86, let me tell you.
So you found out you missed flying? So
oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And during my tenure with the reserve unit at Hill, the Cuban crisis occurred, and Uncle Sam invited me back to active duty. And that's where I wound up at Dover Air Force Base in 1964.
Okay. Is that Delaware?
Dover Air Force Base, Delaware.
Okay, and that's where you flew the
C-133? C-133, Douglas C-133A.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, again, at that time, we were the largest aircraft in the free world. We had 178-foot wings, 158-foot fuselage, four turboprop, 6,500-shaft turboprop engines with 18-foot diameter propellers on them. And we grossed out at 275,000 pounds.
Is that fully loaded?
Max gross,
max, okay.
275. Okay. Now, the aircraft, they only made 50 of them. They were designed as missile haulers. The Minuteman ICBM, in its trailer, with its tractor, we could open the back door, drive it in, lock it down, close the back door, and go. And the Minuteman weighed 98,000 pounds. So that was us.
Do you remember your first flight in this plane?
I do, and my instructor was chewing me out like you wouldn't believe because I was flying the fighters. and rather than looking down the runway in order to find a landing spot, I was looking right over the nose. So it took him a long time to get my eyes up. So anyway, he was on me big time. We were good friends, though.
So how did you like flying that plane?
Well, it was completely different from that.
Yeah.
And Military Airlift Command was, remember MATS, M-A-T-S?
Yes.
Military Air Transport Service?
Yes.
Well, when I got to Dover, I think it was 64, maybe 65, they changed it, and the federal government spent millions of dollars to paint the airplanes to MAC, M-A-C, Military Airlift Command. I was all over the world with that airplane, and I wound up with about 2,500 hours in it in 4 years.
Where were some of the places that you flew?
All over the world. Vietnam. Well, our primary mission was to haul stuff in and out of Vietnam, the combat zone, Thailand, Vietnam. We did not haul passengers outside of somebody on emergency leave, then we could take them, but it was primarily cargo. We would go from Dover, someplace in the United States, to pick up a load, Travis Air Force Base in California, Hickam Air Force Base, Honolulu, Guam, Wake Island, Guam, Philippines, into the combat zone, Okinawa, Midway Island, Travis, back home. And if we stayed on schedule, we could do it in quote-unquote 9 days, but it normally took us well over 15 to make the trip.
Round trip.
Okay. Yeah. It was 95 hours of flying time.
Now, would you do all the flying yourself?
No. There was three pilots on board,
okay.
Two engineers, two navigators, and one loadmaster. That was a quote-unquote global crew.
Okay.
And we could go for 27 hours, I think. Did that a couple of times, too.
Wow.
It was a good thing I was a young man at the time, because they would have completely, totally wiped me out had I been this age now, then. So, anyway, I got the round-the-world trip. We went down to Pensacola, I think, and picked up a couple of Navy propeller-driven aircraft and took them down into South America, right along the coast. I forget, Suriname, Dutch Guiana. And then we went over to Ascension Island. You ever hear of Ascension Island? That was part of the tracking network for the Cape on the missile launches, 4,400 miles downrange. We went from Ascension into Liberia, and then over to Sudan, and then Bangkok, the Philippines, and then back across the Pacific to get back to Dover. And that was 95 hours, all the way around the world. So I've seen a lot of the world. In fact, I'm down to the point in my life where it's the Continental 48 and Alaska. That's it.
You've seen enough.
Very much so.
Now, did you have any particular favorite places to land in? Or did they all look the same?
Nothing in the rest of the world. A couple of very nice spots in the United States. Salt Lake City, for one. Beautiful, beautiful. Really? Well, I was in Salt Lake working for Hercules. Okay. It's a beautiful place and a smooth runway. Well, this was commercially. I flew 30 years for United.
Okay.
So, anyway, I've seen many, 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 many landing strips and managed to get on the right one all the time. So there was some question one day going into Guam. You ever hear of Anderson Air Force Base in Guam?
Yeah.
Well, it's right along the coast, and there's also a civilian runway parallel to the military runway. And we come roaring in. Well, you've been in the air for 8, 9, 10 hours. You're tired. Regardless of whether you're sitting in the seat or trying to sleep, and this was the noisiest, most vibrating machine you ever saw in your life. So anyway, we lined up for the civilian runway, and they said, "I think you're lined up for the wrong runway." So we looked again, and lo and behold, there it was there. So we didn't land, though.
Yeah, you always hear those stories once in a while of commercial pilots, especially landing on the wrong runway.
Well,
there's no
excuse for that, okay? Just like these accidents that have occurred in the last 6 months or so, there's no excuse for any of that. None whatsoever. My complaint, well, number one, I flew the 727 for United for 25 years, and there was no computers on that airplane. You had to know exactly where you were all the time. Whereas today, with all of these computers and the youngsters up there, they, you know, playing the games, I really have my doubts as to whether they know how to fly the airplane if something happens. So,
just too reliant on the technology.
Well, they like to play games, I say. Just like these, they're walking around looking at all these. I don't even know how to do that. I got a flip phone, and I know how to answer it and
make how to make a call,
and that's it.
Well, that's really all you need.
That's as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Well, when the cell phone came out, you remember the brick phone, the big huge thing? It was an emergency vehicle, and I feel the same way with the cell phone today.
Yes.
Emergency.
Yes.
That's it.
So what was it like on your first flight into Vietnam?
Scary.
Okay.
Not knowing what was coming up at you.
Okay. Did they tell you what to expect?
Well, again, the largest aircraft in the free world, and we used to call ourselves the aluminum overcast. We were big. And I did see tracers coming up at me from the jungles.
Ooh.
On occasion. And we didn't even have a pistol on board.
It's not like you can evade it either.
Oh, no. I mean, no. Well, generally, we're on final approach for a runway someplace.
Okay.
And the things are, you know, the tracers are coming up out of the jungle. So, anyhow.
So, where in Vietnam were you landing? Do you remember?
We landed at Saigon, Da Nang, Quy Nhon, and I was involved with hauling the 25th Infantry Division out of Hawaii into Pleiku.
Oh.
And we hauled the entire division in 28 days, I think. There was all kinds of airplanes involved
in
that.
Yeah, must have been.
Say. So that, I think that was, that's about it, the number of places that I got into Vietnam. And Bangkok and what have you.
Any special kind of difficulties in landing and taking off in Vietnam, aside from people shooting at you?
Yeah, one day we landed, I think it was Quy Nhon, to pick up, and most of the stuff that we hauled back into the States were helicopter pieces and parts, and to haul them back in to have them rebuilt, and then we go pick them up in Texas and haul them back over to get shot up again. So Queen Yan, they had had a mortar attack the day before we got there. So there was a bunch of chuck holes in the runway. So that was a little interesting. And when we got our pieces and parts loaded up of helicopters, we were max gross weight for the runway conditions. And right off the end of the runway, there was a little village with the thatch huts and all that kind of. I know we blew the roofs off of the place because we had just lifted off. And again, you got four 6,500 shaft engines out there with 18-foot blades, and I'm sure we blew some shingles or whatever they call them. Other than that, it was just long runways.
Okay. Yeah. So I imagine the climate affected your recovery?
Absolutely.
Yeah. How so?
Climate affects any aviation situation. When it's hot, you use more runway. If it's cold, well, like the wintertime, you can get off the ground a lot faster in the cold air. It's more dense, and the engines like the cold air.
Okay.
Now, the power plant on the cargo airplane was a jet engine. Turboprop was a jet engine with a propeller hanging out on the gearbox.
Okay. So there's a jet engine driving the propeller?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Through the gearbox.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's not a reciprocating engine like the old DC-6s and DC-7s and Super Connies and all that stuff.
Okay. Any kind of mechanical failures you had on a plane while flying it? Losing any engines?
Well, the 133 was a maintenance nightmare. And it didn't take us long to get out past our maintenance line in the Pacific and the Atlantic. But again, it was a maintenance nightmare, and that's the reason our 9-day trips took us 15 or 16, waiting on the pieces and parts and the personnel that knew how to put the pieces and parts together to get out and get to us. Primarily, the worst thing was the propeller. It had 178 moving parts in it. And one part failed, and you had to change your prop. Well, we were way past the props out in the Pacific. In fact, one of the guys took off from Dover. He had 10 props on board. And before he got to the Philippines, he was empty.
So they would carry spares with them?
Well, this was special missions to get the props out there.
Okay.
But again, before he hit the Philippines, he used two of them. And the other eight were used by somebody else out there.
Okay.
Oh, a lot of fun.
Oh, boy. So what's that like just flying over the expanse of an ocean where you have, like, no landmarks, nothing to really guide you by?
That's the reason we had a navigator back there.
Okay.
And he was taking shots off of the sun and off of the stars at night and all that kind of stuff to know exactly where we were.
Okay.
Now, the most hazardous flight of my entire 52 years was one night coming out of Cebu City in the Philippines. Now, every island in the Philippines has got its own private thunderstorm over it every night. And we had a radar repeater up in the cockpit in the forward part. The navigator was back over here, and he was the one controlling the radar. So we were looking at the storm, trying to pick our way through this thing. And we got involved in what we called a sucker hole. It closed in on us, and we got hit by lightning two or three times that night, and it scares you. It scares you. Well, the airplane stayed together, and we managed to get on the ground in Saigon, and it turned out that an antenna coming off the tip of the rudder, a wire going down to the top of the wing, had been hit by the lightning and severed, and it had wrapped around the rudder, and as it turned out, it got in the slot between the solid part and the moving part, which basically saved us because we needed the rudder in order to get this airplane on the ground. But we didn't know that until we got on the ground. So, anyway, that was the most harrowing experience of 52 years and 22,000 hours of flight time.
So you spent your second tour of duty basically just flying between the States and Vietnam?
No, all over the world.
Oh, okay.
This is where I got into all over the world. Okay. South America, not deep South America, along the coast, Brazil, Recife, Brazil, and along the coast. And then over into North Africa. Oh, I got back into Tripoli with that big thing. So, in fact of the matter is that particular mission, we were hauling the Lockheed F-104 Starfighter into Jordan. And we had two on board, and we stopped at Tripoli. Actually, we didn't stop at Tripoli. We went by Tripoli and went into the Gulf of Aqaba into Jordan. And as we went into Jordan, the Israeli fighters were sitting right there watching us and letting everybody know that here we go again. Well, when the Six-Day War broke out, you remember the Six-Day War?
1967?
In the 60s, somewhere along in there. The Jordanians had crashed two of the 104s, and we sent airplanes back in there to pick up what was left and bring it back to the States. So there was, I think we hauled eight of them in there and brought six of them back. So
two of these jets would fit inside the airplane? Wow. Okay.
Take the wings and the tail off.
Okay.
And stuff them in there. Again, you know, you could put the whole Minuteman ICBM in there. So. Now, helicopter-wise, you're familiar with the Huey helicopter? We could put five Hueys on board.
Five?
Take the rotors off, take the tail boom off, put them on the floor, and we could put five of them in there. And generally, maximum weight of cargo going across the Pacific was 50,000 pounds. Five Hueys weighed in the 20s. So,
okay.
But it was full.
That's amazing. You can carry that much.
In fact, one of the guys in Vietnam carried an army tank, which was 120,000 pounds, someplace in Vietnam. They wanted the commanding officer of the army thing wanted his tank moved, so our guy put it on board and away he goes.
So you flew that until you left the service in
1968, February 1968, and I joined United Airlines, and I spent 30 years flying commercially.
Okay. So you flew only the 727 for United?
I started on the 727 in the third seat, the engineer seat, and then the 737 came into being in the early part of 1968, and United was the launch customer for the 737. And I happened to be in the training center when the first one showed up on the ramp out there, so the guys could learn how to fly. And shortly thereafter, I wound up sitting on the third seat of the 737 for 6 months, back to the 27, then the DC-8, and then back to the 27, and then I stayed on the 27 for 25 years and retired off of it, and then I went back to the DC-10 in the third seat for 3.5 years.
Okay.
If we were required to retire at age 60 at that time.
Okay.
It's 65 now. And there was over 700 of us, over 60 guys, that were sitting in the third seat of airplanes on United Airlines at the time. 9/11, all the third seats got retired to the desert. Senior management was after the third seat for a lot of years. So when 9/11 occurred, they got it. So everything was two seats, computers and all that kind of stuff. So, but I retired off the airplane and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And as far as maneuverability, 727 and the F-86, very close.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Of course, we couldn't do that with people on board. But when we were ferrying an airplane, we got to play around a little bit. So.
But no supersonic dives?
No,
the 727?
No.
So the 727 was your favorite commercial?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
Okay. How did you like the DC-8?
It was a big, long tube. Looked like a bowling alley when you looked out the door and looked down the thing. But that was the long-haul aircraft for United at the time.
Okay.
Now, 727, We could go from Chicago to the West Coast. That was the max length of our legs in the country, which was good for me. Two time zones. I don't need anything past two time zones.
No more jet lag.
No. So, well, Europe, you're seven, eight hours off of Chicago. Mm-hmm. In the Far East, you're 13, 14 hours off Chicago. I don't need that. I didn't need it when I was younger, and I certainly don't need it now.
Any particular stories you have from flying commercially for United? Anything that really stands out?
Well, I didn't put a scratch on an airplane. And I used to always fly and know that my mom was sitting right back there in 1A, and I wanted her to be comfortable. And throughout my 25 years and 15,000 hours on that airplane, I made sure she was comfortable. I had no harrowing experiences with the airplane. Shut a couple of engines down, but only because we didn't want to burn the engine up, low oil pressure or something like that. Okay. Just shut them down. And we had plenty of practice in the training center and in the simulators about shutting engines down and flying the airplane on two and this kind of stuff. So. No, I had no harrowing experiences.
So how many total flight hours do you have?
22,000 hours.
Wow, okay. That's more than just about any astronaut.
Well, the age of these guys and the number of years of active duty, they've got a substantial amount of flight time. Yeah. Now, when I got out of the Air Force in 1968, I had 4,400 hours of flight time, I think it was. And that included all the training, operational in the F-86, the C-133, and maybe it wasn't 4,400. But let's say 3,000, okay, somewhere along in there. And all the rest of it was commercial. Okay. Now, I avoided the FAA throughout my entire career. And after 50 years, they rewarded me with it. And I got the Wright Brothers Master Pilot Award for 50 years of safe, accident-free flying.
Wow. Okay.
But I avoided the feds for 50 years.
Well, it sounds like you earned that. So have you flown ever since you retired commercially? Have you ever flown anything else?
I had a Cessna 182. And I finally sold that, and that was the smartest thing I ever did, was to sell that thing. It was just gobbling up the dollars like you wouldn't believe. And I joined a flying club at DuPage, and I paid for what I flew.
Okay.
But about 10 years ago, I decided, okay, that's enough. I've done everything you can imagine in an airplane, and the reflexes were going. So I just, okay, fine, that's it. So I hadn't flown for about 10 years.
Have you ever flown as a passenger since then?
Oh, well, I retired from United in January of 1998.
Okay.
And I have used passes up until the merger with Continental Airlines. And the old United that I spent my entire career with is no longer in existence. What's flying around today is Continental Airlines. And I tried to use a pass on Continental Airlines, and they left me at the gate 5 times in 2 days.
Really?
5 times. So I'm to the point now where I got to go buy a ticket, and I don't even know how to do that. But I guess I'll figure it out somehow.
or take the train.
Could be. I'm no longer into the long-distance driving. That much I'm aware of.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Any people stand out during your military career? Any friends that you remember well? Any other fellow flyers?
Well, I stay in contact with four or five different guys that I flew with in the F-86. And again, we stay in touch, mostly Christmas cards and a little email every now and then. And then the guys on United that I flew with, I'm in contact with some of them. In fact, I'm a member of the Retired United Pilots Association, and there are meetings at most of the large cities in the country of retired groups. And I go to those and see guys that I flew with and all this kind of stuff. So that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, can imagine.
Reminisce.
Yes. Any other stories you'd like to share with us today? Goodness.
Well, I could probably sit here for hours and come up with stories, but...
Any favorites?
Not that I can think of offhand. Okay?
Okay.
I was just wondering if you were talking about tracers coming up at you in Vietnam.
Yeah.
What would that have done to the type of aircraft you were flying?
It made a little hole in the aluminum. Again, we were the aluminum overcast.
Okay.
So we had lots of places that would take bullets. I don't know if any of them ever hit us.
Hmm.
Well, going into Quy Nhon that night, the one that had the mortared runway, we were told that the VC were in the islands just off the coast, and we were on downwind for landing, and the islands are right here, and we got a fire warning over on number 3. We thought, well, they got us. Well, it turned out it was a false fire warning light on the engine. So.
Okay, well, thank you so much for sharing your memories and your stories with us today.
My pleasure.
Okay, thank you.
Great. My pleasure.